even inspiring as our first one was this morning. I'm going to actually give two short talks because in the first talk, which I started out to write, I couldn't think of enough to say, right, that would be useful to everybody. So my first talk, which is Reports Work with done jointly with Mark Sernitsky at UCSB, is about a new challenge for science in a way that is provided by quantum mechanics and the very large universes that are predicted by typical multiverse theories, or in which the multiverse idea emerges. We would like, in principle, to discriminate between various theories that might be proposed of the universe by whether they predict that the data that we observe or not. Now, what we know about our data, the whole totality of it, given by the human scientific, I guess, the collectivity of observers that is interested in constructing theories, is that the universe exhibits at least one instance of it. But in a very large universe, the probability that any data occur, at least one somewhere, in any theory, right, approaches one, if by no other mechanism than quantum fluctuations. So in a very wide class of theories, in any theory, any data will occur somewhere, and how do we know our data isn't one of those? And so that we can't discriminate between such theories by data alone, that in a nutshell is my talk, and the question is, what do we have to add? An example of this is the so-called Boltzmann brain problem, in which, just to give an example, I'll take a spatially closed universe. It's finite in space, but infinite in time. It's our universe, certainly it looks like it's going to be infinite in time. And there's assume, I think people have no idea how to calculate this, but they speculate on this basis, that there's a very small probability per unit volume, four volume, that a brain will fluctuate, it's B-R-A-I-N, will fluctuate into existence for a very short period of time. Since the volume is infinite, the probability is one that there are an infinite number of those brains. If we're typical observers in the class of, in this class of objects, then we're much more likely to have fluctuated into existence one moment ago than to have the 13.7 billion years of history that we imagine we have. The New York Times characterized this in the following way: the weirdest and most embarrassing prediction in the history of cosmology, and I think they're right. Now, I mentioned the word typical, and it's this is a very common assumption in this part of speculative cosmology, that what our data is, it's typical among what many other observers might see. But these typicality arguments are fairly dangerous. And an example is this example of, if we ask the question, is there intelligent life on Jupiter? So now, one line of thinking is that, based on typicality, is no, there can't be any intelligent life in Jupiter, because since Jupiter is very much larger than the Earth, it'd be very much likely, more likely, that there were more Jovians than humans, and then we wouldn't be typical observers in the solar system, because there would be many more of us, of them than us. Now, Paul did use the word absurd, which I meant to ask him what he meant, but I think it, to my way of thinking, it applies to this kind of argument. But otherwise reasonable people like Don Page and Brandon Carter would say that's the right answer, and you shouldn't waste any money sending a space probe to Jupiter to check whether the intelligent aliens, because we already know from this typicality argument that there aren't any. A few homilies on this general line of thinking about typicality. We don't have, as far as I know, any data yet on extraterrestrial observers, or how many of them are, or how much alike they are with us. And therefore, we don't have any experimental or observational evidence that we're typical in any class that contains them. There's no basis for this in fact. There is also no evidence that we're unique in the universe and have been randomly selected by any physical process, and we shouldn't think as though we were. Sometimes people reason, for example, as in the famous problem of why we aren't Chinese, as though we were outside the Earth and somebody had picked a nationality for us by some physical process, then it's much more likely we would be Chinese than that we would be Canadians. That's because there are more places for Russians to be. But there isn't any such physical process, right? Whether you're Canadian or Chinese is part of the definition of who you are. So we don't exist outside the universe. Rather, we're physical systems within it. And the route to clarity, I think, is to make statements that refer to us in terms of our physical description and not as though we were independent of the universe itself. Now, I've just attacked typicality at my peril. But there's one case in which typicality is certainly true. And that's the case when we're typical by definition in the class of systems that have exactly the same data that we do. By exactly the same, I mean everything we've got, not just the measurements in laboratories, but every astronomical observation, every detail of every leap, every description of every person that's accessible from this collection, including a description of ourselves. By definition, we're typical in that class. So typicality, duplication is the only reliable typicality. But if there are going to be things like Boltzmann brains around, then the probability in the universe that our data are, like any other data, are duplicated elsewhere in the universe approaches one. So there's us, and then there's us. So we're used to reasoning as though we're unique, right? But in fact, the implication of these very large theories is that we're not unique, not even close. So that's the Boltzmann brain problem coming back to hit us. There are an infinite number of Boltzmann brains that have exactly the data that we have, much smaller than the total number of Boltzmann brains, of course, but we're more likely to be one of them than in the particular location in the universe that we have. So I'm going to discuss this in a little more detail, this challenge, and then propose some resolutions to it. To do that, I'm going to use the classical Bayesian framework, which is supposed to be a model for theoretical prediction. Using data. So we imagine that we have a class of theories, TA, which we hope to discriminate between them by our observations. Yeah.
The only reliable typicality, what other kinds of typicality might there be that you would regard as less reliable?
For example, this kind
just
of typicality.
Just this kind.
Yeah. Well, I wouldn't want to restrict to just this kind because that seems to be an absurd sort of conclusion. But the typical thing people would like to do, right, is, for example, let's suppose we measure some coupling constants, right? And then we would argue that, well, they should be typical of what other observers would see, and it's very likely there are other observers in every galaxy. So then we would, they would argue that galaxies were a marker for observers and then try to calculate the statistics of the galaxies. So if there were two regions of the universe where there were more galaxies, right, then we would argue there are more places for us to be. That's a possible argument, right? But I don't think it's as reliable, certainly, as just the one where it's true by definition.
There is some tendency around that argument can often be used to say there's no surprise that we find ourselves, for example, living on a planet that has a fairly small eccentricity around its stuff, but this is because we couldn't live on one that had very high eccentricity. So it's not without some sort of value.
Well, those are anthropic arguments, right? And they're possible. They're possible too. So I suppose I don't see that as a typicality argument. We don't live, as you say, on a typical planet, and we could not. But both Earth and Jupiter have small eccentricity.
Yeah.
Actually, apparently, both Earth and Jupiter and all the planets in the solar system have larger eccentricities, right? And it was this theory of the formation of the solar system by Mortadelli et al., which seeks to explain how the eccentricities got less than what you would expect from just the formation in a disk. But that's not right. They're a small one. Okay, so the Bayesian framework has the following ingredients. We have a class of theories TA, which we want to discriminate between, and we have our data, which to be on the safe side, we'll take to be every piece of information we have about the universe, including a physical description of ourselves. Of course, it's hopeless to do science if we needed all that data to discriminate between theories, but in order to avoid contention in that direction, which induces additional theoretical uncertainty if you have to discriminate between which data you can use and which you can't. Let's just take the whole thing. So the other ingredients are likelihoods. Given a theory, we expect to predict the probability for the data. Those are called likelihoods. The data are the realm of facts, and the likelihoods are the realm of logical deduction. And to keep the discussion simple, I'm going to conclude a theory, assume a theory includes everything you need to make predictions of the data. So, for example, Newton's laws of mechanics, by that way of thinking, are not a theory until they're supplemented by some initial conditions that tell you how to compute the probability for our data. And of course, you can consider the whole spectrum as different theories with different initial conditions. You also need priors, which incorporate our theoretical prejudices. And we like theories that are simple, computable, and do various things like Landauer might like, and so forth. And then finally, you have Bayes' formula, which connects the probability for the theory given the data and to the probability for the data given the theory and the prior probabilities. The idea here, of course, is that if you fix these once and for all, and as you gradually get more and more data, as in flipping a coin, right, you will be driven towards the right theory by these probabilities. Okay. But to emphasize this point, all we know from our data is that the universe exhibits one instance of it. And so the relevant likelihoods for the Bayes procedure should really be written out in this long form. The probability that there's at least one instance of data in the universe given the theory T. Some things you can immediately draw from this procedure. So theories are tested using the data D. What other observers with different data might see, how many of them there are, what properties they might or might not share of us are irrelevant for this particular process. Right? You might make assumptions that involve them, but strictly speaking, if we just focus on the data, we don't need to think about them. So we don't need to think about all those Boltzmann brains that don't have the same thing as our data if we follow this particular function. You don't need any additional assumptions of typicality if you just use probability by itself and has a notion of typicality, if you like, built into it. When we say the probability of a die is 1/6, we don't say, and we expect to get a typical answer in a long run of rolls of the die. But most importantly is that two theories that predict equal probabilities that there is at least one instance of our data somewhere are not distinguished by this Bayesian process. And it's just because there are more copies of us doesn't change that probability. I'm going to now illustrate this with a very simple model called the red-blue model. And the model universe is the universe consists of n boxes, which you can think of either as boxes in space or cycles in time. The boxes are either red, some global property, think microwave background radiation, or blue. And there's a probability PE that there's an observing system, of which we're one, taken all identical in this case, right, exists in each box. And there are two theories that are proposed, right? One is that every box is red, all red. And the other is that sometimes it's red and sometimes it's blue. So we exist in one box. We take that for granted. Although, as in the Doonesbury cartoon, even with that, sometimes you get letters, right? And we see red. Which theory does the data favor? Well, so now I'm going to grind through the calculation. Let's calculate the likelihoods. So I'll need, right, the number of, in a given theory, there would be a certain number of boxes that are red. In one theory, that would be all of them. In the other cases, would be a number less than n. Now, the probability that there's at least one box that is red in which an observer exists is 1 minus the probability that there are no boxes in which are red in which an observer exists. That's the probability that there's no observer, which is 1 minus the probability that there is an observer, raised to the number of boxes that are red. So here's a formula for the likelihood given explicitly. Any questions about that? Should I say it again? No? Good. Okay. And so then we can calculate the, suppose we take equal priors for the two theories, and then we can calculate the probability of the theory given the data, and leaving out this normalization, which is the same for both, the probability for a theory is just this. One is proportional to one minus this number times that normalization factor, which is the same for both theories. So now let's look at a certain special cases. First of all, let's take the suppose the probability for the existence of the observer is close to one. So there's more or less an observer in every box. Then this is close to one, this is close to zero. So the probability for each of these theories is about one. So there's no discrimination in the limit in which we're not rare. Right, we occur everywhere. That's not very surprising because the data, remember, is that there's at least one box with an observer seeing red. And if there's an observer in every box, right, then in each of these cases, there certainly is going to be at least one box where there's an observer seeing red. The other limit is to take the probability much less than 1 over n, where n is the total number of boxes. That's the probability that we're rare. And then by advanced mathematics, if you expand this out, assuming this is small, you see that the probability, posterior probability is proportional times the number of red boxes times the probability that we exist. That's the limit in which we usually think, that we're rare and unique in the universe. And so this is the same as if we assume we were unique but didn't know which box we were in. Or somewhat confusingly, it's the same as though we were randomly selected which box we were in. In that case, of course, the all red theory is favored, right, because it has the larger number of boxes and you can discriminate between the two theories. But now let's look in the limit, a different sort of limit, where the universe is very large, and in these two theories, the number of red boxes goes to infinity in both cases. As we carry on, then, because this is a number less than one, and this is becoming increasingly large, the posterior probabilities go to one in both cases. And there's no discrimination between, you can't tell the difference between the two theories on the basis of the data that you see red. So in an infinitely large universe, the probability is one that there is always is one, or approaches one, that there's always at least one instance of our data, no matter how rare it is. So you can't tell the difference just on the basis of data. But it gets worse than this. You also can have no confidence in experiment. Because suppose we have a set of theories which are distinguished by some the value of some parameter. I'll call it lambda, which is guaranteed by all the theories to be constant over the whole universe, and so forth. And we have a series of laboratory measurements of the parameter that give values lambda 1 to lambda n. And we study the experiment, and we think it's a good one for measuring this parameter. Which theory does that data favor? Well, if the universe is infinite, the likelihood that this string occurs at least once approaches 1 in any theory. So the experiments have the lambda 1 through lambda n have nothing to say about what the value of lambda is. So you can't rely on experiment either. OK, well, that's the problem.
So I guess for the clarification, when you say series of measures,
yeah.
This means that in the theory, lambda is supposed to be fixed, but you find that it isn't. So getting different.
Well, if we have a theory that has a parameter in it that's equivalent to a set of theories in which we have different values, the parameters 1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
And you find that in the subsequent measurements you get different values.
Well, it's a possibility the experiments are all a mistake. Think of it that way. Right? And in a very large universe, somewhere there will be a mistake.
Right.
All of them.
Right?
Right? Why aren't we there?
If we imagine, I mean, suppose we take the fine structure constant.
Yeah, that's right.
Example, and we keep coming out with different values.
Right.
So that's would be a job.
Doesn't they don't have to be different? Those are all the same.
Well, it's just you've got different labels. Oh, I see. That's just labels.
That's the succession of experiment. First measurement, second measurement, third measurement.
Right.
Okay. So ways out. So two theories predict the same probability as one for any data occurs somewhere, then we can't distinguish them in this framework. Posterior probabilities are the same as the priors.
So ways out. Well, one way is to require that the universe be finite in space and time. Then you wouldn't have this problem, clearly, because there wouldn't be an infinite number of copies. Don Page was an advocate of this. Not really possible to live with it in space, but it's a little bit difficult to live with finite time, a view of current observational data, which is where the universe is squarely in the Friedman, Robertson, Walker models, in the domain in which it's going to go on forever. Another, I won't discuss this, is to allow, some probability that the universe is has a finite volume. It's a little like coin flipping. You know, if your prior for the coin being fair is one, then no numbers of coin flips will convince you that the coin is unfair if they don't come out the way you expect. So we could go back through that model and do it, but I propose not to do it. Another idea is to change the theory so the likelihoods are different. That's another idea of Don Page, to give up on quantum mechanics as it is, so that the likelihoods are computed differently. I'm not going to say anything about that either. He might be right, but it's just too far for me to go.
The universe, the period in the universe during which observers can exist has to be finite rather than what the universe is.
Fair enough. That's probably right. So he's got to cut off those Boltzmann rings, right, somehow. Oh, I see. But it's in a lot of some sort of new physics, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
A state where you can't possibly observe.
I'm just going to follow for a few more minutes the idea that we should admit that all the data is dependent on the priors and try and agree on what they are. After all, we don't just pick, as far as I know, the Bayesian procedure which occurs in textbooks. I can't think of a single example where anybody ever did it. So we don't, in fact, in physics, take two theories, write down likelihoods, pick out priors, and compute posteriors. Rather, we sort of muddle along, and we select theories by a whole bunch of criteria that are beyond, that aren't necessarily incorporated in that Bayesian procedure. We like simplicity, that they be beautiful, mathematically formulable, as Paul was discussing this morning, economical in assumptions, comprehensive, unified, explanatory, falsifiable, accessible to intuition, and maybe make us typical, and around here, I just added relational for the locals. But most importantly, we favor theories that are predictive, testable, and give a coherent explanation of the data we have. It's a much fuzzier idea, but it's a traditional idea in physics. And indeed, the utility, as Paul stressed this morning, of the physical theory is its predictive power. That is, we're identifying regularities in the universe on which we can rely in the next instance in time, right, so the bridges don't fall down, and so forth. So predictability, if you want to write it out in this framework, concerns a stream of data in time. A theory is predictive when, if you have a certain amount of data up to time tn and the theory, then it'll make a definite prediction for what the next one is. So once again, we favor theories that have a particular storyline. So typicality can certainly lead to predictability, as in the Human-Jovian example. If we assume that we're typical, then we definitely predict that there are no observers on Jupiter. But it's a sort of ad hoc assumption, and it's risky because, as I've already outlined, because it doesn't have any basis in a fundamental theory. But people get, it's no doubt it's predicted. Brandon Carter, for example, using typicality or anthropic arguments, which is essentially the same thing, predicts that life began on Mars and that there are no intelligent observers anywhere from typicality and tabularity. So it's a very powerful assumption. Whether it's right or not is another question. The thing I want to point out here is atypicality, assuming atypicality is just as sometimes as predictive as using, as assuming typicality. Consider two theories, the usual theory, that's what UT stands for, and the usual theory about augmented by the assumption that we, the particular class, live close to the Big Bang. In which case, according to the Boltzmann brain story, so that's us down, we assume we're down here, and all these Boltzmann brains up there, because they're very rare, right, ones that are exactly like us. And so that's our theory. So this theory, the theory of the Boltzmann brains, is not predictive, but the augmented theory
is we can test the assumption that we're living close to the Big Bang by successive predictions of what we will see, just based on usual cosmology. And so there goes the Poulsen Bank problem, in my opinion. So such atypicality assumptions are possible when, unlike the Human-Jovian example, there's a variable in the theory, in this case location, that we can make an assumption with, after all. Somebody has to be atypical, right, in the universe. It might as well be us if that's predicted. Similarly, we restore confidence in the experiment if we have the set of theories. We favor the theory where we take, just say, the average of the data, because it gives a coherent story about the previous measurements. They were accurate, in fact, and not just very unlikely fluctuations. And it predicts the results of future ones, namely that we'll get lambda. None of that's in the Bayesian prescription, but it is typically what we do in physics is to like and go with predictive theories in London within until they're finished. I always like the BBC because and maybe the CBC does this also. It has this thing at the end. In case you have to be attention, haven't been paying attention, you can go with the main points again. When the universe is infinite in either space or time, we'll not be able to distinguish between a whole class of theories, it should have said, by data alone, if the likelihood, well, I guess the qualification is okay, if the likelihood is one that any data occurs somewhere. But we can distinguish them through priors that favor all those other things we like in a physical theory. Namely, it gives a coherent story for the data we have and makes testable predictions or falsifiable predictions for the data we might acquire. And assuming typicality, atypicality can lead to predictability just as much as typicality. Now, do you want to take questions on this now, or shall I change to the other? Let's give the other talk. The other talk is quite different, so if you have questions on this, maybe we should take 15 minutes for them. Well, hi, John. How are you doing? You're looking well?
Thank you. So are you.
Beating the odds.
In the universe, I live with a horizon. And we really can discuss what's within the horizon causal. So, what's the issue of gravity in the universe?
You mean, could we get around it just by saying we should just deal with the finite universe, which is the size of our horizon? I don't know. Maybe that's an interesting idea. I don't know. I was assuming the other case, right? Namely, something come in through the horizon.
Jim,
right?
One of the places where these arguments came up was precisely in theories with the horizon, and the idea that de Sitter space is a theory with a finite number of degrees of freedom. And then people argued against that because of the phenomenon of Poincaré recurrences and the fact that you would get all of these Boltzmann grains in the extremely far future. So it's sufficient that it be infinite in time to have this sort of problem come up. It can be finite in space and even have a finite number of quantum states. But still, if it lasts an infinite amount of time, if you worry about these things, the worries are still there. You don't remove it by just cutting off space or cutting off the number.
So just to clarify, so you say that so your point is that theories that assume typicality can make predictions, but so can theories assuming atypicality.
Yeah.
So suppose I had two different.
Here's my bottom line.
Yeah. So suppose, given that, I could imagine two different theories, one assuming typicality, one assuming atypicality, and they make roughly the same predictions. So do you see any other criteria for distinguishing between them?
Well, I have that list, right, people like.
So then we would go to these meta criteria like beauty and all that, economy and all that stuff?
That's this. There'll be more discussion.
Oh, all right, so you're going to hit on
and it. And more personal choice. More...
So you're going to get into this issue.
Right, I mean, from the objective point of view. But in fact, that's more or less what we do. My impression of the history of physics is we have some theory, we run along with it until there's some contradictory experiment, and we change it, and we run along with something else, and we change it again. It's much more like that, and much less sort of completely objective story.
Well, no, but Jim, there's also the consensus of the scientific community. I mean, I get probably five times a year stuff from people that think they found the right theory, and I don't think anybody else in this room would ever agree with them.
Right. By we, I meant the scientific community.
Am I saying that we were getting to arguments about my atypicality is better than your atypicality?
Yeah.
Sure, that's true.
Think of what fun it will be. Other questions?
Physics will be more like the humanities. All right. I've now got to.
I was so pleased to be moved up this morning before Laura Mercedes' talk, who was going to explain what the multiverse is, because I myself don't really know what the multiverse is supposed to be. And so that gives me some sort of license to talk about this particular multiverse, which is the quantum mechanical multiverse of a particular theory of the initial condition. I'm going to talk about the classical multiverse, that is, different classical histories of the no-boundary quantum state. This is work done in collaboration with Stephen Hawking in Cambridge and Thomas Hertog at the Astroparticle Institute in Paris. Maybe the most striking prediction, or the most striking observable fact, rather, of our quantum mechanical universe is the wide range of time, place, and scale on which the laws of classical physics hold to an excellent approximation. The time, we believe, is the time from the Planck era forward. The place is everywhere in the visible universe. We're setting out on a journey to some distant galaxy. We don't see, we need to equip ourselves with a bunch of interferometers. The laws of classical physics will work just as well there as here. And on the scale, from the macroscopic, whatever that means, to the cosmological. But in a quantum mechanical universe, which I'm assuming, you have to ask, what's the origin of this quasi-classical realm in a quantum universe that's characterized fundamentally by something very different, by indeterminacy and by distributed probabilities? So what's the origin of classical determinism in a theory that basically is indeterministic and has distributed probabilities? A key feature of our quasi-classical realm is the classical space-time, which of course is nowhere guaranteed in any quantum mechanical theory of gravity, because their space-time geometry is a quantum mechanical variable, and it can principally fluctuate. So classical space-time is assumed in most formulations of cosmology. And if you want to stop a talk on something rather than a sure thing, one way to do it is to get up and say, but what if a space-time isn't classical? Something like that. And the classical space-time is the key to the origin of the rest of the quasi-classical realm. I don't have the time to explain to you exactly how that works, although it's an interesting subject, but just to run one sentence through you, once you have classical space-time emerges from the quantum gravitational fog at the beginning, you've got local Lorentz symmetries. Of local Lorentz symmetries, you've got conservation laws. Once you've got conservation laws, then you can have variables that are the conserved quantities in the theory, like energy, momentum, and number, and those are the variables of classical physics, and they persist because of their approximate conservation, right, moving in a classical space. But only certain states lead to classical prediction. So classical orbits, for example, are not predictions of every state in quantum mechanics of a particle. Just write down some random wave function. It doesn't make classical predictions. And classical space-time is not a prediction of every state in quantum gravity. So we need to know, we can trace the origin of the whole classical realm to a particular state in quantum gravity, or a set of particular states that, that predict classical space-time. Now this, so I'll call this the classical multiverse of a quantum state. A particular quantum state typically doesn't predict one classical history. That would be very special, like a narrow wave packet. But rather, it predicts the probabilities for an ensemble of classical histories. If it predicts any at all, and that's the ensemble, which is the typical prediction. And the ensemble, I'll say, constitutes the quasi, we call it the quasi-classical realm, and that's the classical multiverse of any one particular quantum state. So I've outlined very briefly how classical spacetime is the key to the origin of the quasi-classical realm, and the quantum state of the universe is the key to the origin of classical spacetime. And so I'm going to analyze the classical multiverse, right, for one particular quantum state, namely Hawking's no boundary quantum state, in a class of mini superspace models. So here's the no boundary wave function. It's given, it's given by a sum of e to the minus the Euclidean action. I'm working in the low energy theory as always, right, because classical spacetime is a low energy phenomena. So I'm assuming a theory with a metric and one scalar field. We integrate these over suitable contours such that the integral converges and the result is real. When you specify that, you specify a wave function with three geometries and three-dimensional field configurations, and that's the no boundary wave function in the universe. I'm going to talk about mini superspace models in which we assume the geometry is homogeneous and isotropic, given by a metric here, so-called lapse multiplied by d lambda squared, and a scale factor, and I'm going to assume the spatial geometry is closed. So this is the round metric on the free sphere. For the matter, I'll take cosmological constant lambda plus a homogeneous scalar field moving in a just quadratic potential. And the theory, as I mentioned, the low energy effective theory, right, in which the gravitational part is given by r minus 2 lambda multiplied by the Planck mass squared plus various surface terms, and the usual story for the scalar field. So to explain how what kind of classical spacetimes, I'm first going to back up just a little bit and explain at least one way you can get classical predictions out of ordinary quantum mechanics of a particle. Let's suppose you have one single particle with a coordinate q, and you have a wave function which is of the following form. It's a WKB wave function. It's of the form e to the I times some function s multiplied by a slowly varying prefactor q. So when s varies rapidly and a varies slowly, high probabilities are predicted for classical correlations in time of suitably coarse-grained histories of position of the particle. For each value of q naught, there is one classical history. Its momentum is determined from the value of the initial position by this classic Hamilton-Jacobi relation between position and the gradient of the action. And the probability is given by the square of this prefactor. That's classical physics. That's non-relativistic quantum mechanics. Now, in non-relativistic quantum mechanics, I'm going to stress for later use that there are two kinds of histories. All we needed, right, for to make that prediction was this particular form of the wave function. It might have been that that form arose from a semi-classical approximation to some path integral, like it will in the no boundary, but it doesn't have to get the predictions of classical behavior. If it does arise in this way from a path integral, then the histories for which probabilities are predicted are generally distinct from the histories that supply the semi-classical approximation of some functional integral. We'll see that in the no boundary. So here we are in the no boundary wave function. Again, here's the metric, and here's the wave function, which is a now function of the scale factor for the three geometries and the value of the scalar field on those three geometries. And it's the integral e to the minus I times this action. Spells it out here. Over all values of the histories which are regular on a disk and match to b and chi on its boundaries, and over suitable complex contours. So we can try to evaluate that integral. It may happen that that integral might be evaluated semi-classically, that is, by the method of steepest descents. So in certain regions of superspace, the space of size of the three geometries and the magnitude of the scalar field, the steepest descents approximation might be OK.
If that's the case, then the leading order in H-bar approximation of the null boundary wave function will have this semi-classical form. It'll be the value of this action evaluated on the extremum, right? A value of A, phi, and lambda, which extremizes the action, right? So we'll have the form, since that will in general be complex, e to the minus IR, something real, times e to the minus IS, times something real. On the next order, we get a prefactor, which we're neglecting in this discussion, not because it isn't important, but because we can't compute it very easily.
The answer was real.
Yeah.
But you got a complex answer.
I have to add the other complex central part. Thank you.
The extremizing geometries will in general be complex. That is, they're on a disk, right? In certain simple cases, they look like this, namely, if there's no scalar field, they have a Euclidean part down here, and then they have a Lorentzian part up here, joined across the surface where Ki, where the extrinsic curvature is zero. But in general, they'll look more complicated. It'll be Euclidean down at the bottom, and then they'll be sort of complex in the middle and eventually evolve towards the Lorentzian geometry. For no good reason, we call those fuzzy instant
boxes. There isn't any vertical axis in the vector. I could have drawn them each which way, but it's just conventional to draw them up. So this axis in the Lorentzian regime is time going up here.
And below that,
well, it's Euclidean, meaning x, the space is the same. So you have to think the picture, just between us, the picture is a giant fake, right? Because you can only embed this piece in a Lorentzian, Lorentzian phi geometry, and you can only embed this in Euclidean geometry. But the conventions and people like to draw this picture. Pick metrics. So there's a metric that goes from the Euclidean one end to Lorentzian at the other by changing by a different component.
So for the purposes of this talk, although it's possible to do this in much more detail, I'll just take over these rules for making semi-classical predictions from non-relativistic quantum mechanics from here. So following this analogy with the semi-classical form, we'll predict classical Lorentzian histories this time that are integral curves of this action. That is, they satisfy this for the momenta, and the probabilities then are given by e to the minus the square of this prefactor, which is proportional to e to the minus 2ir. In order for this to make sense, of course, ir has to be constant along the trajectories. But we can expect this only when S is rapidly varying and IR is slowly varying. These two conditions are satisfied. These are not the same because the metric on superspace, if you take this, is indefinite. And these constitute the classicality condition that was discussed by many people very early in quantum cosmology. So a few key points about this. The null boundary wave function predicts an ensemble of entire four-dimensional classical histories. These real Lorentzian histories are not the same as the complex extrema that is supplied the approximation in the integral to find the null boundary wave function. There, as we've seen, could be instantons. The Lorentzian histories could bounce at a small radius. Did I mention I was including a cosmological constant? I should have. Right? Or they might be singular at the beginning, or they might be singular at both ends, they're not this. You can think of this as supplying a measure on the classical multiverse. So the null boundary wave function predicts an ensemble, a multiverse, if you like, of classical histories labeled by points in the classical phase space, the values of Q and P. And it's predicted because since there's a relationship between the momentum and the position, remember that P equals grad S, it's a function of Q. If you think of the whole classical phase space of classical histories, it defines some slice on it. So it predicts a one-parameter subset of the two-parameter family of classical histories. In fact, as I'm going to show you, the classicality constraint gives you a boundary for that set of histories. In a way, this way of proceeding gives you resolves to singularities in classical general relativity. Because the null boundary wave function predicts probabilities for entire classical histories and not their initial data. Right? So we don't have to start off and then evolve. as we might be if we were doing quantum mechanics on the surface. But we get whole histories all at once, and they're probabilities. Therefore, it predicts probabilities for late-time observables like the CMB, whether or not the origin of the universe is singular. Indeed, you could say that the existence of singularities and the extrapolation of some classical approximation in quantum mechanics is not an obstacle to prediction, but merely a limitation on the validity of the approximation. Okay, so now we have to get to solving this. Here are equations for solving for the complex solutions that give the extrema, but I just not propose not to go into this. The only point is that it turns out that there's one classical history for each value of the field at the South Pole. If you count the parameters, time is short here. Amazing. So for each value of phi naught, we tune the remaining parameters to find curves in superspace for which IR approaches a constant at large values of the scale factor that's necessary in order that the real part of the action be related to the probabilities. And those are the Lorentzian histories, as you can show. They satisfy the Lorentzian field equations. We extrapolate backwards using the Lorentzian equations to find their behavior earlier times, bouncing to singular. And the result is a one-parameter family of classical histories whose probabilities are this. The classicality constraint is important because it turns out you don't get classical behavior always. I won't demonstrate that in general, but here's just what you get in perturbation theory. If you have a small field perturbations in the Sitter space, there's a parameter mu, which is related to the value of the cosmological constant. So for very big lambda, you get some behavior for the imaginary part that looks like this. The imaginary part eventually stabilizes, so it can give a probability. So it is varying slowly compared to the action. But if mu is bigger than 3/2, it never stabilizes, and you get no classical behavior. So in perturbation theory, this is a very simple consequence of the fact that there are two decaying modes for mu less than 3/2 and two oscillatory modes for being bigger. At any rate, you predict that there are no sort of big empty universes other than the Sitter space that are classic. So here's the result of the calculation. We plot here minus IR. So this is the log of the probability, or half the log of the probability. And we find for a given range of phi naught, remember that labeled all the classical solutions. So this is the probability. Below a certain value of phi naught, this is the whole nonlinear case, by the way. We find that there are no solutions at all. The probability goes up like this. Then we can extrapolate back and find their initial behavior, for example, and lots of other properties. They're singular, right, in this regime and bouncing for this regime. There's thus a significant probability, if we were to get around to evaluating a free factor, that the universe never reached the Planck scale in its entire evolution, but just bounced at a big, really big radius. Here's a phase diagram of the results. And this multiverse, here's phi plotted up this way versus mu. Once again, you see that down here, there are no classical solutions for mu bigger than 3/2. Down here for small phi naught, that is no matter. You need a certain amount of matter in order to have a classical solution. It's the interesting result. And you get singular ones, bouncing ones over here. They're sufficiently small to mean you get them. A minimum amount of matter is needed for classicality. I missed the Arrows of Time conference because of various complications having to do with this, by the way, right? And Thomas's the birth date of Thomas's child, which I was unable to change. But I will make a remark about the Arrows of Time here. One way of defining an arrow of time is by the growth of fluctuations to find some arrow of time, order into this order. The no boundary wave function fluctuations vanish at the south pole of the instant time. And that leads for a prediction of what they do in the Lorentzian geometry, namely that they're small down here at a bounce. And so the arrow of time points in opposite directions on opposite sides of the bounce. Right? So that's a new feature we haven't had before. And that means, in particular, that events on one side will have little effects on the other, because if there are intelligent aliens back here wanting to send us a message up here, they would have to have somehow figured out a way of sending it backward in time, thermodynamic time, from their point of view.
This also has a lot of predictions for inflation. In all the, because of the classicality constraint, in all the ensemble of histories that we have, there's scalar field-driven inflation. Here, for example, is a plot of the instantaneous Hubble constant. This should have been phi naught down here. Maybe it was. And you see that, so here are these curves starting for large phi naught, rolling down the hill, oscillating down at the bottom of the hill, and so forth, in the standard inflationary story. And you see that they're all linear in here, right, which is the characteristic signature of inflation for these models. And here's the number of e-foldings plotted. Look at this green curve. I wasn't able to separate this list from some other models with different values of u as a function of phi. And you see that there is always some inflations, although for smaller smaller values of phi naught, the number of e-foldings gets pretty small. That, on the basis of these probabilities, however, is the most probable situation. So mostly it predicts a small number of e-foldings just based on the wave function of the universe itself. But that's not the only probability we can calculate. In quantum cosmology, what you're interested in for the most part are conditional probabilities. We shouldn't think, I think, that the laws of physics are organized to give a high probability to our particular data or our particular political problems of the moment. At least I hope not, right? After all, most of those features which we see arose from 3 billion years of biological evolution by chance accident that occurred on them. So we shouldn't necessarily expect that we're overwhelmingly probable in the universe just based on the wave function of the universe itself and whatever the theory of the dynamics is represented by that action. So probabilities that can test the theory are therefore typically conditional. They assume some part of our data and predict other. And anthropic probabilities, right, in which we assume something about us, are just special cases of that. So to test theories of quantum cosmology, you've got to search among all the conditional probabilities, dividing up our data in different ways to find which ones give you probabilities close to 0 and 1, which would you would reject the theory, if any. Even probabilities assuming all of our present data are useful in extrapolating what happens in the past. These are what are called in the trade top-down probabilities. So I'll describe those a little bit. So probabilities for what we see, the rather than for what the universe exhibits, the no-boundary wave function predicts probabilities for entire classical histories. Our observations, however, are not over some whole space-like surface. They're restricted to some little part of that surface, which is the size of the Hubble volume with the instantaneous Hubble constant, located somewhere in space-time. Therefore, it's just like anything in the rest of quantum mechanics. You get the probabilities for our observations, get the sum over the part of the complete specification of the state that you don't see, right? So we have the sum of the probabilities for classical spacetimes that contain our data at least once, and then sum over the possible locations of our past light cone where our data is inside them. And this defines the probability for our data that depends only on our past light cone. So if we sum over locations, assume our data locate us, let's for simplicity assume our data at least include the Hubble constant and the mean mass density, then they locate us in these homogeneous isotropic models on some surface in space-time. And so what we know is a little Hubble volume on that surface. Assume we were rare. Remember the previous talk, right? So I'm assuming here that we're rare. We don't occur in many places. Then the sum over, then we have to sum over the possible locations in the surface. And that multiplies the probability for each history by the volume of the surface divided by the Hubble volume, which is proportional roughly to the number of the foldings in inflation, because in a bigger universe, there are more places for us to be. If we're not rare, right, then we're, for example, if we're everywhere, then there is no such sum. So you can at least qualitatively work that out. So by itself, the no boundary wave function plus classicality favor a multiverse with low inflation. But if we're more likely to live ourselves in a universe that's undergone more inflation because there are more places for us to be, and here's an example. Here was our original result, bottom up,
And here's what happens roughly if you multiply by this e to the 3n. You get a curve that goes up like this. Classicality alone is not enough to, in this particular model, not enough to get you up here to a large number of your foldings. But if you include, for example, the age being 13.7 years. I might just mention, since we're talking about this replication in the earlier talk, that we, in an infinite universe, or in a very large one, the probability is one that our data will actually be replicated elsewhere, exactly, as I was discussing in the previous talk. But one advantage of that, there's actually an advantage to that, because that means in summing over our location, we only have to sum over a size of a volume that's comparable to the replication scale on which we are replicated. And that provides an automatic cutoff, difficult to calculate, but it's a cutoff, at least principle, on the infinite sums that occur in typical inflationary theories when you're summing over volume. Well, so here's a big question, which I don't know the answer to. Is the existence of classical space-time a vacuum selection principle in string theory? There's been not too much work on this. Quasi-classical realm is a prerequisite for anthropic reasoning, which is people propose to use in string theory, but it's a much stronger, more objective, and more calculable condition. And it doesn't occur, right, as we've just seen. Well, I'll leave that with you as a question. Here are my main points again. One, only special states in quantum gravity predict classical space-time. The null boundary wave function, which is predicts probabilities for a restricted set of classical history, so it's predictive, that may bounce or be singular in the past, or may recollapse, may inflate or not inflate. The classicality constraint it requires in those models a minimum amount of scalar field, no big empty universe. Probabilities for the past condition on limited present data favor inflation. And we might investigate whether the classicality constraint on the wave function and on the classical solutions of exhibits could be an important part of a vacuum selection principle. Thank you very much. Well, there are two sets of equations we're solving.
The
Wheeler-DeWitt equation. Well, we don't exactly solve the Wheeler-DeWitt equation generally, right? What we solve is we do the functional interval, and the equations for the complex part of that are, they're neither hyperbolic nor Lorentzian. When we extrapolate the Lorentzian histories from data on subsurface, we're solving Lorentzian equations. So the wave function satisfies the Wheeler-DeWitt equation,
Let me put it another way, perhaps. I don't know a way, and perhaps you can tell me that you do know a way, to convert these equations to equations that have an exact quantum mechanical formalism associated with them. In other words, the way in all the my experience with this sort of playing around, you write down some equations which don't have a Hilbert space of solutions, and then either in some approximate way or by second quantization, which I know you don't want to do,
sounds hard to me.
Convert that into a Hilbert space kind of situation. And in the way that I know how to do it that doesn't involve second quantization, you pick a particular classical solution, and then you get a Schrodinger equation for small fluctuations of fields around that particular classical solution, and that has a well-defined probability interpretation. And when you do that, all of these WKV prefactors are common to all of the states in the Hilbert space. And you sort of don't have a way of comparing the probabilities of things that have different classical solutions at their base. And so you seem to
doing something different, right, which is, so I'm not sure what the connection is. So we're starting from what's called generalized quantum theory, where you postulate not so much a Hilbert space, right, as a set of fine-grained histories
right? Then you try to construct a decoherence functional for those. And then into the decoherence functional part of the construction is a specification of the wave function of the universe, which in this case is specified by this functional interval. Then, once you have probabilities for histories, you can ask which are the probabilities high for classical orbits or not. And then there's a fairly straightforward connection of this form. But what you're describing is sort of like is what I call a sort of three plus one formulation of the quantum mechanics of gravity. Imhole, that's we're not going to find that exists, right? Because if you look at the if you start from say this kind of formulation, or let's go back to non-relativistic quantum mechanics, right? If you ask if you read Feynman's book or Feynman's original paper in 48, his first task was to show how you got the Schrodinger equation out of a path integral formulation of quantum mechanics. The key step in that, right, is to assume that the histories are single-valued in time. Because if the histories are single-valued in time, then you can factor the path integral into a part, take a time surface before, which defines the wave function on the surface, back after. But I don't see in geometry how we can expect, there isn't any time for which the histories are single-valued in, right? That is, there's no special class of preferred surfaces, or at least we're assuming there isn't, in which occur once and only once in each history. So I don't think we're going to get a 3 plus 1 formulation in terms of states, and that's the difference between what we're doing and what. Now, having said that, I will agree that you know we made many shameless approximations and assumptions along the way in doing this. There's at least a schema for doing it.
You can show that this functional integral construction exactly satisfies the axioms of generalized quantum theory in such a way that you're calling probabilities are probabilities.
In the sense that they satisfy the if the set decoheres, and I didn't discuss that either, and we don't have a whole lot of control over that. The prerequisite for having probabilities that satisfy that add up in the usual way is that the set of histories you're talking, coarse grain set of histories that you discuss, is the absence of interference between different members.
A well-defined notion of probability and expectation values of observables, even when that's not true.
You're talking about measurement, yes. If you're talking about something about the quantum mechanics of histories where everything is inside. Then if you want to extend it over time, then you have to have decoherence in order for the probabilities to be consistent. This was in Feynman's original 1948 paper, right? He's trying to define, for example, the probabilities that the particle goes to a space-time region. And he discovers that he can't get probabilities that add up to one. What Feynman was missing, nowadays we can do that, but he was missing the idea of decoherence, that you shouldn't assign probabilities to every conceivable partition of the path, but only to those which decohere. Now, there's people want to work on a tough problem. There's one. What is really the appropriate notion of coarse graining for space-time geometry? Now, we're up here on the Planck scale. We say it all behaves classically. But what exactly does that mean in terms of even a fine-grained set in which you have an effective theory? It's a problem which I believe has not even been solved in the classical theory. That is, what do you mean by saying that the Friedman-Robertson-Walker universe is a good approximation to our universe, which on the small scales is arbitrarily lumpy? It's got black holes in it and everything else. How are you going to do that? We say, smear it out, right? But what does smearing it out mean? Since we don't have a background space, then John's going to propose the answer.
Maybe not the case then.
Is this another question?
Technical question.
Oh, well, but, right, so let me just.
How do you prove that you can literally continue your Euclidean solutions to Minkowski Lorentzian solutions when you have gravity?
How do I prove that?
How do you prove weak rotation when you have gravity?
Did you say weak rotation?
Well, because you have Euclidean.
No, we didn't do any weak rotation.
We just evaluated the wave function. So for example, if you have a barrier tunneling problem in ordinary quantum mechanics, and you've got a path integral, you can evaluate that by looking for, in the semi-classical approximation, by looking for, for extremal solutions, which in some places are complex. And those give you the probabilities of just regular histories of the particle. So we didn't rotate anything. We did use Euclidean. We did use Euclidean. But as it happens, right, the solutions are out in the, the extremal solutions are in the complex, out in the complex plane. But you know, with any interval you do, right, if you write down an interval and say use the steepest descents, you have to expect that the, it's a miracle that the things are real. But those are not the histories for which probabilities are being predicted for. They're just the semi-classical. They're just the semi-classical solutions that give you the wave function in that form. In principle, we could dispense with them entirely. Because take the whole wave function, we're strong enough to evaluate it, and evaluate the probabilities. Let's see. I don't know. Okay.
You spoke about the multiverse, but you just meant the many histories multiverse. So it's no eternal inflation inside the model.
Well, that's an interesting point. I wonder if I. I had to ask some stuff here. I think I better talk rather than take 5 minutes for it. So, of course, the obvious thing is to now look, we did the homogeneous isotropic model, so look at the fluctuations, right, which we're working on now. There it seems, remarkably enough, that if you take these top-down probabilities, so the no-boundary proposal from the bottom up favors homogeneous universes because it costs action to make a fluctuation, so they will be damped. But if you look at the bottom-up probabilities, I'm sorry, top-down probabilities, that are everything conditioned on our data, then it turns out that you can make the universe larger, right, if you like, by giving it some long wavelength fluctuations. Okay, so the probabilities are actually higher, as far as we can tell, that the universe is, in this linear regime, is lumpy outside the present horizon. Remarkably enough, the place, the wavelength, where it occurs is exactly when the perturbations satisfy the eternal inflation condition. So that suggests to us there's some connection. But we have a very different picture of this large universe, which is coming from, if you like, from the top down as well as the bottom up, rather than from eternal inflation, which just starts it off. But we seem to be remarkably enough headed in the same direction. I think that's as much as I can say right now. So we're busy calculating these fluctuations and trying to make the connection with eternal inflationary predictions to see whether we get them in a different way or different predictions and so
on. You need more inflation because there are more bases for us to be. So if you
the probabilities, given our data, which is a limited regime, there's more locations for our Hubble line. And so we had some correspondence.
So, so yeah, that's right. Eternal inflation has even higher probability.
Well, so we're working in a particular model. We're working homogeneous isotropic models, and so that has to be said. So there's no room for the kind of little fluctuations, bubble nucleation in there. Yeah. It's not so easy to do even this kind of rule limited calculation. We'll get there. Same with the arrow of time, and we have lots more information about the arrow of time, the growth of fluctuations, so forth now, and so forth. There's another problem of time. Well, there's enough time to get it done, right? Right behind the writing papers. And my collaborators are doing it on the floor. Any other questions? Hello.
I'd like to ask a question about your first book.
My first book,
correct. What's puzzling me is an apparent inconsistency between what you're saying in MATLAB and things I've heard you say in the past. So you can comment on this. As you probably know, you're somewhat famous in the philosophy of physics community for not listening to philosophers who tried to raise conceptual problems with the notion of probability.
Really? I had no idea. I thought it was the philosophers of what kind of came to.
Is this familiar conversation that goes something like this? Hartman stands up and gives a talk about consistent mysteries, and the philosopher raises his hand and says, look, I want to know, is it the case that all of these histories are real, according to your theory, or is it just one of them? And Hartman says, well, I don't know what you mean by real, so I don't understand the question. And the philosopher says, look, it makes a difference, because if all the histories are real, you can't go around saying the probability of such and such history is 1/10, because the probability of all the histories is 1. And then the conversation gets nowhere and everyone goes to dinner. Fine, but then in the first talk today, you seem to be saying, look, it's not good enough to just have some mathematically well-defined measure on the space of universes within a multiverse. You need to worry about issues like the fact that in a multiverse setting, it wouldn't make sense to say the probability of this little bit of the multiverse is 1. You have to acknowledge the point that if you really think that the whole multiverse is real, the probability of pretty much anything whatsoever is 1. And so when you try to apply the Bayesian updating formula, things get messy, global likelihoods of 1, and so forth. Do you see what I mean? I'm not sure how to put those two things together.
I'm not sure it's really inconsistent. We were working within one universe, which I was taking implicitly to be large. And we were allowing quantum fluctuations. So what we were assuming in particular is that we, like every other system, are quantum mechanical, and that's somehow outside the universe. Right? So it's certainly a consistent history story, as of many other kinds. And therefore, by quantum fluctuations, any data that we have might have had, is reproduced somewhere in the universe, right. Probability 1.
Right.
So that poses some problem for this Bayesian way of thinking, because that means all the likelihood for at least one instance of the data are 1.
Right.
So why don't we stop there? Was I invoking something about the reality of the multiverse I wasn't aware of?
I was assuming
probability. Right? So this wasn't the quantum mechanical multiverse I was talking about in the second one, which probability would arise.
I don't see why it would make a difference if the multiverse was quantum mechanical or not.
So how would this fit, right, in the quantum mechanical story? When I'm talking about it, so let's suppose each of these classical histories, they could get very large, and therefore the data could be reproduced in each one of them.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So I'd have to talk about the probability in each one that there was at least one instance of our data. If you'll notice on the crucial sign, I assumed we were rare, which is the case when it's predicted, but all that stuff that in the first talk would be imported into the second talk, right? But history by history. So it would be a difficulty in each history. So all those probabilities I talked about in the first talk would have to be multiplied by the probabilities for that history in the second talk.
Okay, let me just try one more.
Right.
It seems to me that if you've been consistent and you stuck to the principles you advocated in the first talk, then when you're talking about consistent histories, you shouldn't be happy to say, I've got a measure over histories, and furthermore, it's a probability measure.
Well, you
should be saying, I've got a measure over histories, but I'm not going to treat it as a probability measure, because this is a multiverse, quantum mechanical or otherwise. The probability that each history is realized somewhere in the multiverse is 1. That's the only probability on the table. I'm not saying that's right, but I'm saying it seems that that's what you should say if you also want to say all the things in the first.
So it's a conflict not with probabilities, but a conflict with this. This idea that somehow we might occur in each history, is that what you're sort of suggesting? Would seem.
No.
And remember, I think we have to have this event. I'm sorry if I didn't mean to be condescending to a philosopher, but it's true. I think that all those slogans, right, that we had in many worlds, quantum mechanics, that they were all equally real, right?
Well, I wrote a whole essay on this, right, explaining what I meant by it. But I think basically you could cross that those all out, and the physical predictions of the theory wouldn't be changed. Now, I'm not saying my philosophical obligations wouldn't be changed. I don't actually know what those are. And I understand the perspective that you should then, if you're going to say, if you're going to adopt a position in real, then you have to somehow derive probabilities, which is what we did a long time ago, and a bunch of other people. Even I did it a long time ago. I'm not even aware of. So I'm not against that. It's just that for these particular more practical problems, it's convenient to start from assuming the measure, the probability measure. If you get a different answer, then that will be very interesting. But so far, you seem to be getting the square of the wave function and so on goal. Let's chat at lunch. I hope, like any other philosophy problem, it's going to take me a long time to get up to steam.
Could I ask you to be a bit more specific about the top comment, any special states? Can you be a bit more quantitative? Just how special?
That's not totally easy, partially for the reason you mentioned, right, that we don't exactly have it. But we can sort of ask that question in the context of non-relativistic quantum mechanics. So the situation is a little more complicated. The question is, what do you mean by classical behavior? In particular, what coarse graining defines it?
Yeah.
Okay. So one thing you can say is if you have, so what does classical behavior mean in the first place? It means that there's a high probability for correlations in time of a set of alternative histories, right, that exhibit deterministic equations of motion. Those are classical equations. So, in some sense, say you have a universe in a box, there are always, no matter what the state is, there is some classical behavior, because you could just take the total energy and repeat it over and over again. And that would be a history that behaved deterministically and classically. But if you start to, but you can make estimates, and I've done this, of taking a very large box, and then taking some fine graining, some coarse graining on the scales that we might usually associate with the quasi-classical domain of, say, millimeter, or a tenth of a millimeter, or something like classical behavior. And then you can start counting the conditions for it to be decoherent and classical. You find that they're much smaller, right, than they're restrictive on the number. In a finite dimensional Hilbert space, they're restrictive on the it's a much smaller than the size of.
I'm trying to press you to give us a number.
Yeah, but I haven't got it. But anyway, if you read my paper on classical behavior of one
so if we now.
I forgot the name of the paper also, where I did try to estimate it.
Because it will be a small number. It's a bad version.
Yeah.
So now if we.
But if that's in a highly set of restrictive conditions.
Right? Yeah, no, I understand that. But if we now combine that with the typicality. The typicality. I mean, can you now reason that observation requires a classical, quasi-classical space-time?
Yes. I don't think we need anything for that. I mean, obviously it's behaving classical.
What we observe is, yeah.
Okay.
So could we have observers in non quasi-classical space-time?
I don't know the answer. This is the.
Is there
life in momentum space?
Right.
Well, boy, you're well beyond my level.
but also for the Boltzmann brakes. So, yeah. I mean, is there a class of quantum Boltzmann brakes?
Well, there's what they're all quantum.
Well, yeah, but when the brain, when you get the fluctuation, it's a quasi classical fluctuation.
Well, it's a question of how long it lasts quasi classically. Mm-hmm. Most of them, I suppose, won't be quasi classical.
Right. And then the question is, will they be observers?
I'm glad. What I would like to do is to say, well, look, right, let's take the theory to be that we're not Boltzmann brains. We did the Riemann fluctuation. We now live 13.7 2 billion years after the beginning. What do we predict next? And we go out and we see what we got. And if it agrees with that, we feel better about the theory, even though the crummy Bayesian probability is. I I'm proposing not to work on refining the notion of bolts and rings.
Well, I was just trying to turn this around and say, could we argue on the basis of typicality that to be an observer requires a classical regime?
Well, we need a bigger notion of observer that doesn't already implicitly assume that. Let's take, I mean, just the simplest fact property of an observer is that they're a localized system. Now, where did that come from the universe? We didn't have any localized systems in the beginning. It came from a whole fairly complex set of things. First of all, there was expansion of the universe that drove the characteristic energy scales away from the Planck scale. So then you have classical space-time in which you could define a notion of location. And we had fluctuations in gravitational attraction, which led to the formation of fluctuations, which became independent subsystems. It's a fairly complex and interesting story, but I have no idea how to formulate that in.
But we could imagine a world in which there isn't this quasi-classical regime, which maybe nevertheless still has observers. I mean, I'm just thinking of, you know, David Deutsch's argument for the multiverse. Observers who are in superpositions of quantum states, and they have this sort of thought experiment.
We are in superpositions of quantum states. We're all Schrodinger cats.
Yes, but
Hawking's wave function in the universe.
Superpositions of mental states. That's what observers.
We're in superpositions of mental states as well.
Are we?
Well, let's suppose one of these things was due to a quantum accident or something like that. Just for purposes of superposition. Let's suppose a Geiger counter goes off and you look at it. Right. Another branch. We're all in a superposition.
Well, if by we you mean the.
This is Hillary's speciality. What's we on the other branches? Well, we're defined, Paul Davis has defined a certain level of coarse graining.
Right.
Right? And so we take that coarse graining and we can define alternatives for what happened before. Right? So, Paul looked at the Geiger counter and got a certain registration. He didn't. They're in a superposition.
But these are all decoherent.
Yes.
So I'm asking if they're not decoherent.
Well, that's even worse. And I don't know what the probability, we don't have a notion of consistent notion of probability. So if you're going to define an observer, if you're going to find some observer in some way that doesn't involve a probability of a correlation between something, then you're well beyond me. I'd be interested to hear how you're going to do it. Probabilities. What is an observer, just sort of intuitively? Right. Here I am. I'm looking at Keith in the back. Hiya, Keith. Right. In the back there. And so there's some correlation between Keith and me. In another branch, Keith might have sat in a different chair and there'd be a different correlation.
Yeah. No, I understand that. But
that requires probability for the correlation, and certainly just, I think, requires classicality to describe Keith, the chair, everything, different time, etc.
Well, that's the point I'm trying to drive. That, you know, can we conclude on the basis of the argument of typicality that we must have quasi-classical world, including quasi-classical space-time, with decoherent histories in order to make sense of observers?
I myself don't like including things on the grounds that I don't know how to do it. But I don't know how to do it, therefore it must be impossible. Right, because then the next day somebody comes in and does it in some way. So my real answer is, I don't know. You can say it.
Any questions?
Thank you, Jim, again.